Let's administer the Buddha's words on loving kindness. This is what she said.
I one who is skilling goodness and who knows the path of peace, let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings they may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through error or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
So, we humans have minds that are like a ship adrift on the ocean. It's directed by wind and tide. Wherever the wind blows, the ship goes. Wherever the tides take it, the ship goes. It goes from here to there, all over the place. This is our normal state, where we think we're in charge, but in fact, the tide of ignorance and the wind of desire are the ones that are really in control. We wish for this, we wish for that. We go seeking happiness here, seeking happiness there. Wherever the wind blows and the tide takes us. This is our normal state of mind. And while we are ruled by ignorance, driven by desire, we tend to seek out the lower, unwholesome states of mind. We seek to develop greed, ill will towards others, jealousy, envy. Because we associate these things with what we need to make us happy. But all this is driven by ignorance, delusion. But if we don't break the cycle, if we don't set ourselves a direction for ourselves, then we'll always be at the mercy of ignorance and desire. And that doesn't just apply to this life, but ignorance and desire form what our future lives will be like. Because these desires for sensual pleasure through the eye, ear, nose, and all the different sense organs, cause a response, and they cause the wind to blow harder, or the waves to be higher, stronger. And unless we start to understand that this is the case, then we're doomed to be reborn life after life. Even though we might not know what our previous lives were, or where we're going to be reborn. This is the law of cause and effect. We here, in this room, have been born countless times before, sometimes as a human, sometimes as some other being, a ghost, an animal, a deva, a heavenly being with no body, simply mental energy. There's a whole raft of beings in the wide cosmos, but they are all subject to the law of karma. The law of cause and effect. All subject to various degrees of ignorance and desire. But the Lord Buddha realized that bobbing around on the ocean at the beck and call of ignorance and desire is only a recipe for suffering. It brings no real joy. The only thing certain in life are aging, sickness, and death. And all of those experiences are suffering. So he looked for a way to understand better what existence was all about. And it took him some time and several teachers to actually find the path that he taught to everyone else. And he said, for those who were to follow him, that there were seven factors of enlightenment that they would have to practice if they too were to become enlightened and free from suffering, free from being the slave of ignorance and desire. And those seven factors, he said, were like the roofing timbers that support the roof of a house or a hut, where they all point to an apex. And the apex, when they all come together, was enlightenment. But along the way, there are different levels of those factors. The first factor is mindfulness. If we want to develop our practice to the extent that we are going to become enlightened, then we need to practice all of these seven factors which I'll go through. Because they not only lead to enlightenment, but they are also powerful practices in their own right. It's said that at the time of the Buddha, that one of his senior disciples, Mahakasapa, was sick with very poorly. And so the Lord Buddha decided to pay him a visit. And he asked Venerable Kasapa how bad the pain was, and Venerable Kasapa said, it's very bad, very strong, very painful. And then the Lord Buddha taught Kasapa the seven factors of enlightenment. And on hearing that and having his mind so focused on what the words of the Buddha were, Mahakasapa was able to get up from his sickbed, being cured of his illness simply by the power of his own mind, after listening to the Dhamma and understanding what these seven factors of enlightenment are. And there are other examples in the suttas where the power of the seven factors of enlightenment are explained, where there are examples of just how powerful they are. First of all is mindfulness. Then there is the investigation of Dhamma. Then there's effort, energy. And there's joy, rapture. There's calmness. There's concentration. And there's equanimity. So the first one is sati, mindfulness. I spoke a bit about that last week. But if you were to examine the nature of what's bobbing around on the ocean, rudderless, you have to do so in the present. You have to see things occurring as they occur. It's no good having one's mind thinking of the past, daydreaming of the future, because that's just the wind and the tide pushing you in one direction after another. Mindfulness at least lets you know what your problem is. It helps to fix the mind and train the mind, just like the leash that the dog has helps him stay by the side of his master. Mindfulness provides the opportunity for us to examine the present moment. And it's key to the development of our meditation. If we can't be mindful and can't keep our minds in the present, then we can't understand the present. And seeing as how the past has gone and the future hasn't yet arrived, the only time any real knowledge and understanding can occur is in the present moment. So mindfulness and clear comprehension become an extremely important, essential tool. That's why sati, mindfulness, is also on the Eightfold Path. Samma sati, having right mindfulness. Mindfulness and vigilance. Mindfulness so that we can be aware when we start to think unwholesome thoughts, when we start to perform unwholesome acts, when we start to have poor or bad speech. Mindfulness says, whoops, this is what's happening right now. And then with a bit of analysis, we can see, oh, that's unwholesome. So then it gives us the opportunity to be able to correct our bad behavior. Equally, if we know what's going on in the present and we're participating in wholesome actions, we have wholesome thoughts, wholesome, good speech, then mindfulness lets us know in the present that that's what we're doing. And so we can analyze that as well. And we can say, well, this is good. So therefore, we must promote this. So mindfulness forms part of the basis for wisdom to develop. We develop more wisdom when we look at investigating the Dhamma. When we look at cause and effect, when we see that our craving causes us suffering, when we see that unwholesome states of mind are not helpful, when we see that practicing meditation, being virtuous, being charitable, giving to other people, giving of our time, giving of our possessions, giving of our friendship, that these things are good. They make the mind calm. When we start to realize these sorts of things, then we set the foundation for wisdom. We set the foundation for insight, which then in turn sets the foundation for enlightenment, which is free, which is what will free us from the rule of ignorance and desire. So then we practice to maintain those things which are wholesome. How we put in effort to develop new good qualities in our personality. So if we weren't previously a generous person, we start to develop generosity. If we were a hateful person, we start to develop loving kindness and compassion. Now we're starting to put in right effort because we're seeing the unwholesome side of our character and we're trying to avoid it. We see the wholesome side of our character and we try to promote and improve it. And that's right effort. And as we do this, we become joyful. Because piti is one of the factors of enlightenment in Pali for joyfulness. And it's also one of the factors involved in the practice of jhana, the practice of strong concentration. Because if we're not joyful in what we do, if we don't find pleasure in practicing the Dhamma, eventually we'll get tired of it. Because that's our nature. That's avijja, or ignorance and tanha, desire, fighting back. They don't like being tamed. They don't like being leashed. They don't like being ordered what to do. And they will fight back. And so we have to find joy, we have to find contentment within the practice of Dhamma, because if it starts to irritate us, then our practice will drop off, we'll go backwards. Now, piti, while it's a factor of enlightenment, it's also a hindrance. Because it can be that you become just so caught up in being joyful, especially in deep states of meditation, that you don't want to do any more. You think you've done enough, that peaceful state is just all that there is. No more work to do. And that's a defilement in its own right. So you have to get a right balance with all of these factors, so that you don't end up deluding yourself into thinking that you've got further in your development than what you actually have. When you have joyfulness, you can develop calmness, passivity. And what's the difference between calmness and concentration and joy, you might ask? Calmness means calmness of body and calmness of mind. In particular, for those who have trodden on the path, calmness refers to the fact that if you become, say, a sotapanna, a stream entra, on the path to enlightenment, passivity occurs because you've lost the first three fetters which tie your mind into this world of birth and rebirth, samsara, the wheel of life. And those three fetters, once gone, those fetters of sakkaya ditti, thinking that there is a self somewhere in this human form, either of body or mind. When you become a sotapanna, you know for a start that there is no such thing. Sakkaya ditti, the false view of self, goes. Belief in rites and rituals goes. And doubt. Doubt in the path, doubt in the Dhamma, doubt in the Buddha, doubt in the Sangha. That also disappears. And when that's gone, those three factors which disturb the mind, once they're gone, then of course you have a deeper basis for calmness. And so in its more elevated sense, being calm means the removal of those hindrances, the removal of those fetters which stir the mind up and keep it locked into the world of ignorance and desire. At a more mundane level, when you practice anapanasati, when you practice mindfulness of breath, you breathe in knowing this is a long breath, breathe out knowing it's a long breath, breathe in knowing it's a short breath, breathe out knowing that it's a short breath. But as you practice through there, you calm your body down. you start to feel the body settling down. And that too is a form of calmness. Then when that happens, then you turn your attention to settling the mind, calming the mind down, helping it to be released from the frantic activities that it's undertaken for most of the day. Just calming the mind down, slowing the breath, calming down. That again is the beginning of calmness. And again, it's the beginning of feeling satisfied. Because again, when you're satisfied, when you're happy, when you're joyful and you're satisfied, then you're likely to stick at your practice. Then there's samadhi, concentration. There's two types of concentration. Well, depending on how you look at it, there's either two or three. But effectively, concentration in this sense means being able to focus your attention on a meditation subject and see that whatever it is that you're focusing on, whether it's the breath or the body or feelings or the fleeting nature of the mind, that all these things are impermanent. They arise, they have a lifespan, and then they disappear. And because they are impermanent, they are suffering. Because trying to be attached to something which is going to disappear only breeds unhappiness. Like when we drive the new car out of the showroom only to find someone drives right into the side of us. How happy are we then? Our joy at buying the new car changes to being sorrow at the fact that it's now written off. So concentration and being able to examine, using our other examination of Dhamma that I mentioned earlier, being able to use that investigation, being able to see that all forms of existence are impermanent, that they are suffering, and they are void of any self, devoid of anything substantial that lasts forever, and that it in itself doesn't change. Within the framework of the human condition, whether it's the body, whether it's feeling, whether it's perception, whether it's thought, the thought process, memory, or whether it's consciousness, all those things arise and pass away. There's nothing within those five elements, those five khandhas, those five parts, that is permanent. And the more we examine that, the more we change our outlook on the world, and the more we take control of the ship that's floating on the ocean. And by the time we get to this stage, we're now starting to set some direction ourselves. Ignorance and desire now no longer having it all their own way. The defilements of greed, ill will and delusion are not having it their own way. We're now fighting back. We're now taking charge. And finally, there is equanimity. Because we need to be equanimous if we are to travel the middle way. The Eightfold Path is all about balance. Only an arahant or the Buddha can be fully equanimous. That means we neither think good nor bad of things that arise and pass away. They simply follow their own nature, and we allow them to do so without being attached to them. Only by complete non-attachment can we be fully equanimous. If we are attached to something, we will have an opinion about it, and that opinion won't be equanimous. It will be either good or bad or some shade of grey. So we have to try and practice equanimity. And we have to practice all these seven factors. You don't just practice them the moment that you become enlightened. They are stages. They are things to do, things to improve, things to try hard at doing. So that they change our perception of what this conventional world is. The world which is ruled by defilement, the world that is ruled by greed, hatred and delusion. Because Dhamma, learning Dhamma, practicing Dhamma is all about seeing the conventional world for what it is, instead of the deluded way that we usually look at it, where we think these things belong to me, they are mine. This is my pain, this is my happiness, these are my things. This is beautiful, this is ugly. This is the way we view the world. But we have to re-educate ourselves and see that life is suffering. That what we call beautiful, someone else calls ugly. It has no that object has no intrinsic beauty or ugliness. It's simply the way we think about it. It's simply the way we perceive it. And the way that we respond to what we see, what we hear, what we feel, what we think. This is what drives us, and this is what creates karma. And this is what keeps us bobbing along in the ocean. So we have to practice the seven factors of enlightenment and keep them front and center. When we even go about our daily business, where mindfulness is the key. And if we do this, then we can slowly but surely start to change ignorance into wisdom. And as we do that, we lessen the hold that ignorance and desire have on our minds. And when we bring them, all seven factors, to come to join together, that's when we will experience complete freedom. That should be the goal of all of us who want to practice. Whether we do it in this lifetime or whether we do it in another lifetime, it's still the same goal. It may take us more than one lifetime to become enlightened. It took the Lord Buddha many, many lifetimes. And we've had I don't know how many lifetimes before. But at least we've got some good karma because we've come into contact with the Buddha's Dharma, with his teachings. And so we should take this opportunity. We should rejoice in this opportunity. We should be joyful. Because we have now got the tools that we need to be able to free ourselves from suffering. And there is no greater treasure to be found than the Buddha's Dhamma. And so I implore all of you to practice so that you can become free. That's it for now. We'll do some meditation. So sit comfortably. Feel yourself sitting. contact with the floor or the chair. And just feel yourself relaxing into that position. Don't try and force yourself to sit uncomfortably. Now make a determination that you're going to have your mind focus on your meditation subject for the next half an hour. So if the mind drifts, simply be aware that it's drifted. Bring it back. For those who don't have a meditation subject, then just try following the breath. Wherever you feel the breath coming in or going out, just place your attention there. If it helps, you can count the breath one at a time until you go from 1, 2, 3, up to 10, and then start again. Just so that you can follow the breath and go 1, the out breath comes, 2, or you can count 1 is the in breath, 2 is the out breath. Doesn't matter. It's just there to help you keep your mind, your attention on the breath, wherever it comes. And as you breathe in, feel that breath flowing through your whole body, just relaxing you, calming the body down. Breathing's getting slower. Then feel that breath calming your mind. Feel your thoughts, all the things that the stresses of the day, all gone, all going out with the out breath. Calmness coming in with the in breath. Stress going out with the out breath. Feel that breath, just the gentle touch. Just keep the mind focused there. If the breath disappears, don't worry, you won't die. Just keep watching. Just let the mind settle. And place your attention on that joyful feeling that arises. Even if the breath is gone, that joyful, calm feeling will replace it, and that's where you put your attention. over for now. Reach the end of our time of meditation. So just come around in your own time. There's no rush. Just feel that relaxation. So, has anybody got any questions? I've explained things so wonderfully well, no one's got any questions to ask. Okay. I guess that's what Sundays are for. Over to the Master of Ceremony.
Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness thou hast us from thy practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon pattern through your bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all the desires and attachments completely cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all of these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Thank you all for coming.
So you're going to do a chat for us?
Am I going to do a chat for you? You've just heard it. I could do the blessing, I can do that. But I'm not going to. I leave that to monks. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.